Welcome back to those of you joining us just now. I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable. We are podcasting our show, and you can find out more information on our website. Click on kalw.org and go to news, and you'll find our program listed there. You can also listen to past shows and subscribe to the Your Call podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And if you have a show idea for us, we'd love to hear from listeners with ideas. You can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. And you can join our conversation today anytime by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us with any questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. And now we're going to turn our attention to the worsening humanitarian crisis in Gaza. People in Gaza are dealing with ongoing Israeli airstrikes, including while trying to access desperately needed aid. The UN reports that Israeli forces have killed more than 1,000 people in Gaza gathering to seek food. And amid widespread starvation, Israel has continued to expand its ground operations across the besieged territory. According to the health ministry, in Gaza, at least 59,000 Palestinians have been killed since the conflict began back in October of 2023. To get the latest and the prospect for a potential ceasefire in Gaza, we are very pleased to be joined by two special guests. First, we're joined by Sharif Abdel Kudus, an award-winning journalist and Middle East editor at DropSite, which is an investigative news organization, independent and dedicated to exposing the crimes of the powerful, particularly in overt and secret conflicts where the U.S. government is playing a role. Sharif, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost and the author of a forthcoming book on the Biden administration and Gaza titled Crossing the Red Line. Good to have you back, Akbar.
Thanks for having me, Ethan.
So, Sharif, let me begin with you. It is becoming increasingly difficult to describe what's going on in Gaza. The whole population is suffering from malnutrition. And a growing number of people are literally starving to death. We're seeing images and videos of children dying from hunger in the hospital. And then those who are trying to get food are now shot by Israeli soldiers. The UN is calling these so-called food distribution points death traps. So, Sharif, can you just give us a sense of the situation on the ground right now in Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult to describe. I think, you know, we've been watching over the past 21 months, live stream of people being bombed and torn apart and neighborhoods being destroyed and hospitals and schools being devastated. And now we're watching a live streamed famine happening. And this is not, I wouldn't describe it as a humanitarian crisis. This is a deliberate campaign of forced starvation. And what we're seeing now is that it's reached a tipping point. Since the war began, Israel has obstructed aid in different ways, kind of perpetually underfeeding Palestinians in Gaza, but always kind of relenting just enough to avoid mass hunger mortality. What that changed in March, on March 2nd, when Israel violated the ceasefire and imposed a full spectrum blockade that de facto continues to this day. So since March 2nd, you know, they cut off all food, fuel, medicine, all aid into Gaza. Then in late May, they began letting in meager amounts of aid through a system overseen largely by what's called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, a U.S. and Israeli-backed group. And the aid that's even being so-called distributed by this group is not enough. But as you reported, and as was predicted, there's just four distribution sites by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, three in the deep south of Gaza, one in Wadi Gaza. They're all in militarized zones. Starving Palestinians are forced to travel many kilometers to reach these areas, and they are shot and shelled and attacked by Israeli soldiers and by American mercenaries working for the GHF on a daily basis. And over 1,000 people have been killed in less than 2 months at these sites. And so what's happening now has been predicted by food experts, biohumanitarian experts, that this is going to happen, that we're at this tipping point now where over the past 5 days alone, there have been 54 recorded starvation deaths. This is compared to 68 recorded over the course of the war before that. So the famine has now gathered momentum, accrued over months of deprivation. And it's really difficult to watch as people, you know, we see journalists that I'm in touch with, that I work with for Dropsite, telling me that they can barely stand up because they don't have enough food. Doctors who have to treat all these cases of malnutrition and starvation themselves are severely weakened because they don't have enough food. So this is happening before our eyes, and there's hundreds of trucks just on, you know, that are just standing there within Gaza that the UN is unable to distribute because of Israeli obstruction. And just on a final point, we heard today that Israel said it would allow other countries to airdrop aid into Gaza, and Jordan and the UAE are expected to begin airdrops in the coming days. We've seen airdrops taking place a number of times in Gaza over the past 21 months. These have not resulted in sufficient amounts of aid reaching Palestinians. They've also led to deaths and injuries multiple times. And the head of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, said today, airdrops are the most expensive and inefficient way to deliver aid. It's a distraction to the inaction.
Yes. Well, it's just shocking, and I really appreciate your work, Sharif, to just highlight what's happening, explain what's going on. Akbar Shahid, Ahmed, I just wanted to ask you if you had anything to add to what you're hearing in terms of what's going on the ground in Gaza right now.
I just think it's important for people to remember how big of a role the United States is playing here. You know, Sharif was making a great point about airdrops. The Biden administration, which initiated the policy of largely on tech support for Israel leading us to this point, tried airdrops for months. You know, and we just saw Gaza's situation worsen and worsen and worsen. And the US, of course, is a big player in this failed aid distribution system. And finally, the US is really seen as the only player that can pressure Israel to stop aid obstruction, to allow the safe delivery and distribution of aid, which is a major problem. And aid groups are noting, you know, that they have the capacity, they have the expertise, but their workers themselves are starving and they can't leave their homes necessarily safely. So there's a real role for the US, and you've seen other governments step up. The French government this week announced a new step of kind of pressuring Israel by recognizing Palestinian statehood. That doesn't necessarily feed anyone in Gaza now, but it's a signal of how other governments are trying to exert new levers. We have not seen the U.S. do that, even as the situation has deeply worsened.
Yeah, and Sharif, on that point that Akbar just mentioned about France potentially recognizing Palestinian statehood, other countries may join as well, other European powers may do that as well. What do you make of those declarations if they happen? Do you think it's going to change anything on the ground?
Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to change anything on the ground. And in some ways, you know, what is this recognition of? What statehood are they recognizing? Without changing actual policy towards Israel, this mass killing and forced starvation will not stop. So while I think it's welcomed by Palestinians, the recognition, it's not going to really do anything on the ground. You know, Israel is coming under increasing pressure because of this mass starvation campaign. We saw recently 28 countries, including major European powers like France and England, issue a joint statement just on Monday saying that the war must end. Israel must immediately lift restrictions, allow the flow of aid in. We saw four of the world's largest media institutions, the Associated Press, AFP, BBC News, and Reuters, declare that they're desperately concerned for their journalists in Gaza who are unable to feed themselves. We've seen over 100 aid organizations also issue a statement saying that aid has to be allowed in and overseen by the United Nations and other aid groups, not by the GHF. And instead of opening up and allowing aid in, Israel just recently has pivoted, and they've pivoted by launching a new propaganda campaign aiming to pin the blame for the ongoing famine on the United Nations. You know, they basically invited dozens of sympathetic journalists to a crossing in Gaza, showing pallets of aid sitting on the Gaza side and claiming the UN won't distribute it. But, you know, this just flies in the face of reality. Israel has restricted the movement of the United Nations. They cannot move without Israel's consent. They impose logistical, administrative, operational obstacles on the United Nations. And we saw one of the worst aid massacres on Sunday when a convoy of World Food Program trucks entering through the Zakim crossing in the north was attacked by Israeli soldiers, killing over 80 people just seeking aid, gathering around the trucks. You know, and this provoked a rare condemnation from the World Food Program, who put out a statement saying, you know, Israel just opened fire from tanks and from guns on starving Palestinians. So, you know, it's really an incredibly dire situation, and the world is kind of just watching this unfold. And I think symbolic actions like recognizing Palestine as a state do not go far enough.
If you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind, and you're listening to Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're talking about the ongoing crisis in Gaza, the situation on the ground. We're joined by Sharif Abdel Kudus, an award-winning journalist and Middle East editor at Drop Site News, which is an independent investigative news organization. Sharif received a George Polk Award for his investigation into the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, an Emmy Award for his coverage of the Trump administration's Muslim travel ban, and an Izzy Award for his coverage of the 2011 Egyptian revolution. And we're also joined by Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost and author of a forthcoming book on the Biden administration and Gaza titled Crossing the Red Line. And the phone lines are open. If you have been following what's happening in Gaza, if you have relatives, friends in Gaza, in that region, and have thoughts to share, experiences to share, if you have questions for our guests about what can be done to address this crisis, the number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or go ahead and email us at yourcall@kalw.org. Akbar, I wanted to ask you about the situation in terms of the United States here. What's happening in the U.S., how the U.S. is responding to this, how it might be abetting what's happening. We just saw that President Trump has suggested that if Hamas is refusing to agree to a truce because it fears what happens after they release the hostages, and it appears to suggest that the U.S. and Israel are not ready to guarantee a lasting end to the war, even with the release of the hostages, but rather just a short-term truce. So what are you hearing from within the administration in Washington and the federal government about this situation and the United States' role in it?
The U.S. has played an important role as the kind of mediator, which is a controversial role given its overwhelming support for one side, but it is the key mediator here. And we did see President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, yesterday essentially abandon the talks, the U.S. role in the talks to try to reach a deal between Israel and Hamas. What we're seeing is, while President Trump and many of his officials have said, we're trying to end the war, we want to bring home these Israeli hostages, of whom there are still 50, around 17 or 18 of them, quite possibly still alive, they haven't been able to get Israel to budge in any significant way, right? And it's actually quite a repetition of what the Biden administration did, where they frequently said, we're very close to a deal, we're very close to a deal, we're closing the gaps. And the situation on the ground for Palestinians just kept getting worse, while Israeli hostages, one of the ostensible, you know, chief concerns of this war and of Israel's offensive, continue to die, right? Continue to experience the same horrific conditions in Gaza that Palestinians are experiencing. And I just broaden out the scope to think about Israel's argument for this war and the justification for U.S. support has been the October 7th horrific attack by Hamas, the taking of hostages, which is a war crime. But it's really important to remember that the response to that is also bound by the laws of war and international law. And we've seen Israeli officials this week, in addition to, as Sharif mentioned, blaming the UN, they've always been blaming Hamas without providing evidence, saying Hamas is diverting aid and pacified people are desperate. Now they're also saying, look, Hamas's grip on Gaza is weakening. And Israeli officials have kind of been pushing that narrative. It is not legal under international law to use starvation as a weapon of war, even if you are weakening your enemy. That is not acceptable. And I think people kind of need to remember that those fundamental principles, which Israel and the US both say they adhere to, are quite clearly being breached repeatedly. In terms of officials and what I hear kind of from State Department folks, we have to remember the State Department just lost 3,000 officials, among them the director of the Office of Israeli-Palestinian Affairs. So the undercutting of the U.S. diplomatic apparatus at a time when diplomacy is important is another big reason why we are where we are.
And Akbar, is there any daylight at this point between the Trump administration and Israel? I mean, you mentioned that Biden administration officials are getting very frustrated with Israeli leadership, and it sounds like maybe there's some similar dynamic, but at the same time, the Trump administration just approved a $510 million weapon sale to Israel, in addition to billions that have already been sent over. So is there any daylight, if not perhaps publicly, privately, are there any dissenters left within the Trump administration?
Yeah, there are some. There are certainly voices inside the Trump administration that are more skeptical of intensive support for Israel. And interestingly, coming from a quite different perspective from the Biden administration, where there were dissenters who were basing that on legal grounds or humanitarian grounds or strategic grounds. These are people who are saying we should be focusing on Asia, the Middle East doesn't matter to us. Those voices are there inside the Trump administration. But I think the reality is that starving babies in Palestine is not what motivates those officials, right? So I think what one often hears, given the volatility of decision-making in Trump's Washington, is people really pick their battles, and they keep their powder dry for the battles they care about. And I haven't got the sense yet that even the wing around President Trump, including Vice President Vance, some of his advisors, some folks at the Pentagon, notably a chief policy official, these are people who are a little more wary of Israel. I don't know if this is the fight they want to pick, where, you know, President Trump may also again pull the United States into, say, a war with Iran alongside Israel, right? They might be waiting to push him against that. So I think this is not the moment right now where they're weighing in. And then, of course, the people on the humanitarian front, humanitarian experts, have been en masse, mostly marched out of government.
Sharif, Akbar just mentioned the war crime by Israel of not allowing humanitarian aid in there. And so what is happening then at the international level to try to stop this war crime of preventing food and aid getting in to Gaza? I mean, what is the state of our international institutions at this point?
Well, I mean, I think the most significant attempt was done in Bogota, Colombia, earlier this month with the Hague Group, with a few dozen countries getting together to actually try and put forward a set of real policies, including sanctioning Israel and other policies that could actually force some kind of halt to the genocidal assault on Gaza. But I think something like only 12 out of 31 countries signed on to a set of agreements, and they're waiting until the UNGA in September to finalize that. I think the scale of the crisis right now is that we might start to see the number of indirect deaths, and by that I mean deaths from starvation or malnutrition, start to outpace the number of deaths from bombings and shootings. We may have reached this tipping point. And what food experts and humanitarian experts will tell you is that once famine is reached, it's too late. It's not that if you open the borders and you start, you know, pouring in food that you can stop it. It also has a very severe effect on society. It becomes a social breakdown because people are so hungry that there's a desperation that happens. And it's something that society is very difficult to recover from. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. In terms of the ceasefire talks, Israel and the United States walked away from negotiations yesterday. It's unclear. Qatar and Egypt are saying the negotiations are still ongoing, and there is talk that a 60-day pause may happen. Hamas in the past has said that it would, you know, one of its red lines was that an agreement that the war would, a permanent end to the war, they wouldn't sign something where it's just 60 days, they trade captives, and then the genocide resumes after the 60 days. But I think they've reached a point, and most Palestinians in Gaza, I think, are pressuring Hamas to sign anything at this point, because the situation has become so dire. But the conditions that the original proposal that Israel put forward, you know, were not, I think, acceptable to anyone. One of them included kind of building what UN experts have called a concentration camp in southern Gaza, where Palestinians would be kind of forcibly displaced to, and that's where the aid would be. They stipulated that the aid would continue to be overseen by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. And there was no clear indication of any sort of withdrawal to areas back in Gaza by Israeli troops. We've seen over the past several months, Israel has carved up Gaza through these military corridors. There's a military corridor that cuts off Rafah from Khan Yunis. There's a military corridor that's cutting off eastern Khan Yunis from western Khan Yunis. And for the first time this week, Gaza's last standing city, Deir el-Balah, in central Gaza, this is the only major city that has not been subject to a massive ground invasion by the Israeli military since the war began. The only city that has not been completely devastated. We saw a large ground operation there for the first time this week. This is the place where the United Nations and many international NGOs moved their headquarters to after Israel invaded Rafah in May of 2024. They created yet another displacement order, a red zone that stretches all the way to the coast through the southern part of Deir el-Balah, that includes the locations of these UN agencies. The World Health Organization offices were raided by Israeli soldiers. Men were stripped naked and interrogated at gunpoint. Women and children at these offices were forced to displace to the coast. The UN has said it won't leave because it can't. There's nowhere else for it to go. And, you know, so this is kind of like the situation we're at. And so the ceasefire negotiations are at this place where there's a real desperation for kind of Hamas to accept anything, but there's certain very basic things that need to be agreed on. Otherwise, there's no point in signing it.
Yes. Well, we have a number of comments here by email. Penny writes, the U.S. is complicit in this horrific ongoing tragedy. We should never have sent weapons to Israel. I am disgusted with Trump and Biden over this issue. I am beyond sad watching this genocide at the hand of Netanyahu and the Israeli government. And Stephen Sommerstein writes, I hear from my Israeli friends of efforts to oppose and remove and prosecute Prime Minister Netanyahu, but little reports from NPR. There are enormous number of Israelis and American Jews who are aghast at the right-wing extremists dominating these inhumane actions. Hamas could undercut Netanyahu by releasing hostages and have not. They are tactically in league with Netanyahu. Netanyahu is bad for Palestinians and Jews. He has to be removed, hopefully, at the next election. Well, we're just about out of time here. I appreciate those comments. Akbar, I wanted to ask you a final question here as we're almost out of time. Just first of all, your response to those comments and, you know, more broadly, what is the sort of end game here for the United States? Trump has talked about forcibly removing, essentially ethnic cleansing Gazans out of the strip. So what is the long game here for the Trump administration?
I do want to pick up on that interesting comment by Prime Minister Netanyahu, just because two things. I think, you know, American Jews, many of them have been in the anti-war movement for months and months. Israelis are waking up to a degree we have not seen them do over the last months. So that is significant. But I just note that the broader Israeli political spectrum, even beyond Netanyahu, is at this point quite uncompromising and quite anti-Palestinian. So even his kind of top rival for Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has said he would not accept a Palestinian state and attack France for stressing that. So I just think people need to kind of understand the Israeli political mood. It's easy to sometimes individualize Netanyahu, but there's a whole system here that's evolved over decades and spread to many other parties and figures.
Briefly on the end game, just we have a few seconds left here.
On the end game, I just say the question I think remains of whether Palestinians will retain any control over Gaza and whether we'll see a return to this conversation of forced displacement, which Israelis have never abandoned. The U.S. did stop talking about moving Palestinians out en masse, I'm very curious to see and alarmed to see if the Trump administration starts to endorse that idea once again.
Yes. All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you both, Sharif Abdelkoudous, award-winning journalist and Middle East editor at Dropsite News, and Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost and author of a forthcoming book on the Biden administration in Gaza titled Crossing the Red Line. Thank you both so much for coming on and explaining to our listeners what's happening on the ground in Gaza and the U.S. politics surrounding it as well.
Thank you, Ethan.
And to listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast, visit kalw.org. You can also find us on iTunes and social media. Email us with show ideas or feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihe Raz is on produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.